session number 24573, Reel 8.
This is Darcy, Reel 8. Now, as you, what was the procedure for getting the ship ready to, I mean, you know, to commission and then, of course, to leave?
Well, it was getting all the, ironing out all the wrinkles, really, getting the watch bills sorted out, getting the men settled in their mess decks, making sure that we had all the food and drink and ammunition and fuel and everything else that we needed to get the ship going. The engineer had to sign off that he was quite happy with the motive, the power machinery, the motive power machinery, and we had to be just ready to go to sea. And I had to get all my confidential books buttoned up, which was a horrible job. And Benson, of course, looked after the ASDIC side of it very well. He was quite happy with the equipment, which I may say was British, not American. The ASDIC equipment that we had was the 144, and it was very, very good equipment.
Now, what about the actual commissioning ceremony? Were you there for it, I presume?
Well, there was no great ceremony. Nothing. No, there was no official sort of thing that happened, as far as I remember. It was just, I think the captain and the engineer had to sign for all sorts of things to say that they'd taken the ship. The ensign was broken out, and she became a naval vessel. And that's when it all started, really.
Now, what about your sea trials? You do some local sea trials, then you went to Bermuda. What about the local?
Well, we started off, once all this had been done, it was agreed that we would go to sea and do some speed trials and engine trials and all that sort of thing. And so we went off from the Navy Yard into the deep sea off Cape Cod, and we did speed trials and all sorts of engine trials with the dockyard people on board. They naturally wanted to make sure that everything was fine, and the chief wanted them there so that they would make sure that everything was fine. And we did all that sort of thing, checking of fuel consumption on the engines and speed availability and what revs you needed for what speed, because it's all very important when you're giving instructions down the voice pipe to the quartermaster. You want to go 12 knots, for example. You don't say speed 12 knots, you tell him how many revs you want, the revolutions per minute on the engine. So that all had to be calibrated and worked out. And the compasses had to be swung and checked and made sure that they were all okay. We didn't do any gunnery trials at this stage. That all came later.
Any particular problems, or was it?
No, it was all fine, except we did have one problem. It was quite a funny situation, actually. We were in the harbour in the Navy Yard, and the ordnance artificer, that's the gunnery mechanic, came to the gunnery officer one day and said, "I'm having trouble on a gun closing the breech. I'm using a practice round of ammunition, a round of practice ammunition, and I'm ramming it into the gun, and the breech is only closing about three quarters of the way." So Guns said, "Right, I'll come up and have a look." And he went up on a gun with the artificer, and he watched him try this with ramming the shell, the dummy shell, into the gun. And sure enough, it was only going about three quarters of the way. And he suddenly thought, well, it might be happening like this because the practice round of ammunition is not nearly as heavy as a live round. And if it was a live round that you rammed it in, the extra kinetic energy force of it might allow the thing to close up properly. So he got the tiffy to take a round of semi-armor-piercing ammunition out of the ready-use locker at the side of the gun, and he rammed that into the gun, and sure enough, the breech closed, treat, and the gun fired. just like that. And a round of semi-armor-piercing ammunition went sailing over Boston, landed in a Jewish cemetery somewhere, to the consternation of some Jewish gravediggers, I think. And in the newspapers, I think it was the next day or the day after, it said something about the British shelled Boston for the first time since 1776. So that was one problem we had with a gun, but that was put right eventually. I don't know what the trouble with it was, why it had done.
Was there any particular comeback on any?
No, I don't think so. No, not, there might be in peacetime. I'm sure somebody would sue somebody, but they hadn't got quite like that in those days. Anyway, we did all this, and then eventually, when they'd done as much as could be done, we were then sent north to a place called Casco Bay, which is off Portland in Maine. Yeah? And there we did more speed trials and gunnery trials now. We started actually firing the guns, and we found that they weren't too bad. They were reasonably accurate. And of course, hopefully, we always hope that if we ever had to use them, we'd be using them at close quarters. But anyway, we did all that. We did more engine trials, speed trials, and all the rest of it up at Casco Bay. And it was there that I had to take the ASDIC crew to the American attack teacher, which is their sort of equivalent of what we had at Osprey. And we did very well. That's the thing I was reading out here before. We went to the American attack teacher, and we spent 3 hours doing what we had been doing in Osprey, only using American equipment, which was very different from ours. The whole transmission arrangement was differently organized to the British. And this was quite interesting.
And why did you need to do that? Because you had British equipment.
They did. We did indeed, but it was felt a good idea that you could never get too much practice. And they had this facility there at Casco Bay Training Center, it was called. And they wanted all the ships to send their crews up there. So I went up, and I got a very good report. I've got it here. I mean, there's no point in reading it all out. But I'll just read the final thing, where it says, "This is a report on a British destroyer escort. Their procedures and terminology differ in some respects from our own anti-submarine warfare procedures. The sound operators, that's to say the ASIC ratings, they were an alert, well-trained and interested group. They seem to have mastered the techniques of operating the stack." Very American. "Their calling of Doppler was particularly good. The recorder operator, the work on the recorder was good, with some tendency at times to read range rates too low. Conning. The conning was all done by the sound officer." That's me. "He did very well, as evidenced by the large number of hits. The time was divided between depth charge and hedgehog attacks." And I got, I think I got a 75%. "Assuming the depth of submarine is known, what percentage of attacks result in kills?" 75%. So I got a pretty good report, and we all did, from the Americans on that particular score.
Now, when did you go to Casco Bay? What month would this be?
This would be October.
Still October.
October. No, getting towards November now, I should think. We must be at the end of. The end of October. Oh, I remember. It must be after Halloween, because I remember we were in Boston for Halloween.
So, November.
Say, sometime in November we were up there, and we were up there probably for 10 days, doing all these various trials and checks and tests and things. Then we came back to Boston, and I think we did whatever odds and sods needed doing to round off the whole thing. And we stayed in Boston then for some little time, I can't remember how long, and eventually they sent us off down to Bermuda. And this was really the first time we'd done a long trip at sea. It's, I suppose, something like 1,000 miles from Boston to Bermuda, something like that. And we went down, this was now, I think, December, end of November, beginning of December. And we did a lot more, we went to a place called, we anchored in a place called Grassy Bay.
Can I ask about the voyage? Did you notice that the ships are quite well known for their rolling? And I wondered whether you'd noticed it.
Not particularly, no. I never heard anyone mention it particularly. They did roll. I mean, they did. But there again, so did destroyers and frigate, the other ships I'd been in. They all rolled a bit. It did have a good tendency to roll, I must say. But not too dangerous. Nothing that ever bothered us. Not that ever I remember any bother with it. We had a thing called a clinometer on the bridge, and you could actually watch this as you were going along. It's like a pendulum, you see, and it was calibrated either side with degrees. So as the pendulum went over to that side, you could read how many degrees you were rolling. You know. And in really bad weather, it went to pretty horrendous angles. But it never made me feel dangerous. I never felt it was dangerous. It was always perfectly comfortable.
No, I interrupted you. You were saying, where did you go at Bermuda?
We anchored in a place called Grassy Bay. I can remember that name. There was no dockyard or anything for us to go into. We just anchored there. And we spent a lot of time there doing more gunnery practice and speed trials, and, you know, generally just working up, I think, is the expression that they used in the Navy. We were working up the ship, getting it to, hopefully, a stage where it would begin to be of some use as a warship. And this went on a couple of weeks or more, I should think. And just before Christmas, 20-something of December, we were instructed to up sticks and away to Newfoundland. So we went, I think on the 22nd of December or something like that, we up sticks, up anchored, and set sail due north to Newfoundland. And in 3 days, about, we got from this beautiful subtropical, wearing your shorts, swimming over the side climate, into a howling horizontal blizzard in a place called Argentia. In Newfoundland, it was such an enormous contrast. Anyway, we stayed there for a little while, and then we were told we were going home. And we went as part of additional escort to a convoy that was already going anyway. They tacked us onto it, just as an extra, and we had a quiet passage back to the UK. And we went to Belfast, and that was to be our home then for the rest of our time as an operational vessel.
So you got back in January 44?
We got back, yes, we got back at the beginning of January, sometime early to middle, well, I can't remember exactly the date, but in early January anyway.
Was this at Pollock Dock?
Yeah, that's right, absolutely, the Pollock Dock.
And which escort group were you to?
Well, now this is we were to form an escort group, a new one, and we were to form an escort group called EG1, First Escort Group. And the commanding officer of the group was to be Commander Clive Gwinner, Gwinner, and he was in HMS Affleck, Affleck.
What did you think of him? You'd had this other good one you liked.
Yes. Well, this bloke was terrific. I mean, this one I knew much better. I got to know him over a period of 18 months or what we were with the group, part of the group. We got to know him quite well, personally, and all the rest of it. Much better than I had any of these others. I'd never been with them long enough, as you'll appreciate.
What was he like?
He was a typical RN commander. He was smart, absolutely pin sharp at all times. He spoke in a rather clipped sort of way of speaking, difficult to describe really. He was a very extrovert man. He liked people to like him, I think. He was a good sort. He was a very bright officer. Very, very bright man indeed. And I don't quite know what his previous history had been, but he'd been involved in the anti-submarine war for some time in other groups, or another group, I don't know exactly which. And he was determined that his new group, the 1st Escort Group, was going to be a good one. And he had six ships in his group. There was Afflick, there was Balfour, and there was Bentley. Those three were all turbo-electric. And then the other three were Garlies, that's G-A-R-L-I-E-S, Gould, and Gore, which were all diesel-electric. So the ship, the group consisted of those six ships, and we all operated out of the Pollock Dock in Belfast, and we were to be what you might call a hunting group. We were not going to be used purely as convoy escorts. Our job in life was to be, to go where the submarines were supposed to be and seek them out. That was really the plan. And that's what we did. We used to get the submarine situation report every day, issued by Admiralty. Admiralty used to do radio fixes on the German submarines when they were sending their transmissions from out at sea, and used to get a pretty fair idea of the general location of where they were. And this used to be notified to all the groups, and then in accordance with Commander Gwinner's wishes and also the instructions from CNC Western Approaches, I can't think of his name either. He was our boss anyhow. He was in Liverpool, the headquarters of the Western Approaches control was there in Liverpool, and we basically went where we suggested we should go, and they agreed, or vice versa. They would tell us sometimes go somewhere else. And we went, and that was our job, was to go out and find German submarines where we could.
So you were a sort of hunter-killer group?
That's right. Indeed we were. That was exactly what we were supposed to do.
Now, before we go on to the actual operations, how did you get on with the crews, well, the officers, I suppose, more to the point, of the other six?
Oh, all right. Okay. No, very well. We used to have parties. I mean, you can imagine the sort of situation. When naval vessels are in harbour, and especially when they're in company with a lot of other similar vessels, you do get this tendency for these parties to boil up at any given moment, really.
Well, what would a typical party be like?
Booze up, basically. Blokes used to come from the various ships. One ship would invite the others. There would be a signal going out from the wardroom HMS Gore to wardroom officers, 1st Escort Group, right? And the signal would simply say, RPC, 1800 hours today. And RPC meant request the pleasure of the company at 6 o'clock tonight on board the Gore. And they would all reply, the wardroom officers would then reply, either WMP, which meant with much pleasure, or MRU, much regret, unable. It was all quite.
So, how many would turn up on average?
Oh, you could have 20 of them turn up quite easily, you know, and there'd be a right old booze up in the wardroom.
What was the drink of choice?
Oh, I think gin was the main one. I didn't like the
stuff. Were you still on beer?
I preferred beer, but we didn't have an awful lot of that, so I used to have the odd sherry. I was never a great drinker, to be absolutely honest. I didn't like gin. I'm not a great spirit drinker. I like a drop of rum now and again, but I'm not a spirit drinker.
Would people get drunk? I mean,
some did. Our captain did. Very sometimes, which often made me wonder if he had a problem of some description. It never he never drank at sea, so it didn't matter then. But in harbour, parties, he really could sink them. Well and truly.
To the level where he'd have a serious hangover.
Oh, yes, yeah, you have a serious fall down sometimes. Yes, I'm afraid that was the situation. But he wasn't alone in that. There were others like it as well.
Would you have music?
Sometimes. I'm trying to remember. No, I don't think we did, really. We used to have... it was all just talk.
General, was it one of these things where you weren't allowed to talk shop, or would there be a lot of talk?
There'd be a fair bit of shop talk. And then sometimes, of course, blokes used to bring wrens along, or waffs, or girls from the services, you know. And you'd have a sort of a mixture then of people, girls and blokes and girls on board. And it was basically just drinking parties, to be absolutely honest.
What would happen when you went ashore? We might as well leave the operational.
Yeah, oh sure, leave that to the next.
What would happen ashore when you?
Well,
went
ashore, you sometimes just go. I remember we used to go to a place called the Officers Club.
What was that like?
They're dancing and drinking basically, and girls used to be there. Sometimes, I don't know who these girls were. I never really found out, to be perfectly honest. A lot of them were wrens and waffs and ats who were brought there by various officers who had girlfriends. My own situation was a bit different at that time. I hadn't mentioned that in 1942, when I was on leave from Scarpa Flow, I went back to the old report and control centre where I used to work at the ARP. And I met the girl who later became my wife. And that was in 1942, and in fact we got married in 1944. So at the time we're talking about, 1943, I didn't have any girlfriends because I was stuck, not stuck, but I had my nearly fiancé. She was nearly almost my fiancé at that time. In fact, she was my fiancé, come to think of it. Because I just suddenly, I'd forgotten to mention, I bought a very nice engagement ring in Portland, Maine, and brought it back with me. So I was in fact engaged. So I didn't have any girlfriends at that time at all in Belfast.
Now, what did the Officers Club offer? Sorry.
Well, you could get snacks, drinks and music. That's all. I was only ever there in the evening. I don't know what went on in the daytime, if anything, whether they had card rooms or anything like that. It was nothing very special. It was a fairly sleazy sort of place, but this was in Belfast itself, and it was not bad. But I wasn't concerned with it much.
Would you go for a drink? I mean, you like beer. Would you go to a local pub?
Oh, I used to go to a local pub. Sometimes there was a big hotel in Belfast called the Grand Central, I think. I sometimes go there for a pint with one of the other chaps, you know. But really and truly, social life, apart from these parties on board ship, was very limited. Very limited indeed.
What about your relationship with the sort of harbour officers? You know
Well, we didn't see many of them. There was the depot ship in Belfast was called HMS Caroline. She was an old First World War cruiser that had been moored up there in Belfast for donkey's years, and was quite incapable of going to sea. And it had the sort of base staff based in it. And they were mostly wrens. There were engineers, engineer officers and gunnery officers and people like that, ASDIC specialists and so on the base staff. But apart from when they came on board for a check on our equipment, we didn't see much of them.
Now, one last thing before we broke. A lot of the ships, the captain class, were refitted and all the American fittings taken out.
Well, yes.
Was there any question of that happening?
I think they took out the ice water fountains and the ice cream machines or something, I think, because these are things that the Americans went in for in a big way.
What about the laundry?
No, I think they left the laundry. As far as I remember, the laundry was left. I don't remember the laundry going, but the ice cream machine and the cold ice water fountains, they went. And they were very good for fresh water, these ships. We had things that they called evaporators, which made fresh water from seawater. And we've never had any shortage. It's very nice to be in a ship where you never felt there was any shortage of fresh water. It used to taste slightly flat, a little bit on the flat side, but it was perfectly drinkable and great for washing or anything else. So we were never short of water as long as the old evaporators were still working.
Did you have any practice training as a group, before you went out?
No. We did all that when we went off on our first trip. When, at the beginning of February sometime in the early part of February, we set off on our first patrol as a group. And we did an awful lot of group training at sea, on our way down the Irish Sea, in fact, just as soon as we left harbour, Gwynna started putting us through our paces of positioning the ships and all, getting in various formations and practicing at the guns and all the whole shooting match, even dropping depth charges.
Real ones?
Real ones, yeah, in the Irish Sea. Yeah, and then blokes, other chaps would come along and haul the fish out that they used to kill.